You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Good morning, and welcome to the Asia Society. I'm Vishakha Desai, president of the Society. And on behalf of all my colleagues here at the Society, I want to welcome you and thank you for joining us on this Monday morning. I was just speaking with some of our speakers, and we all were saying, why did we decide on Monday morning? And we all decided it's because, actually, we wanted to make sure, number one, that we did something on a day that would bring you to the Delta region of Burma. So the weather is exactly right. The other reason is that topics like this, we really try to do it so that we have the right people, the right speakers, the right people who can give us insight, even if that means it's Monday morning. So this was really the only day that we could get all the right people together, and that's the reason why we are here on Monday morning. Before I actually introduce the program, I just want to remind you and just tell you a little bit about these wonderful drawings that have just come to us from Burma. And these are drawings of the cyclone Nargis itself, created by children 8 to 10 years old in the Irrawaddy Delta in Burma. And these kids were given crayons and papers and asked to draw what they wanted to tell people who were not in the storm about what happened. And this was done while their parents were waiting to receive food and supplies by private teams of volunteers, primarily young Burmese. This particular thing was done actually at a center called Gitamet, and this was a music center which was started by a pianist, Kit Young. And actually, Kit Young is related to the Asia Society because her father was actually the president of the Asia Society many, many, many years ago. And her mother, Trish Young, has been a very good friend of the institution. And this is a not-for-profit community center and a music school in downtown Yangon that's devoted to music teaching, nurturing artists, performing, and offering exchange possibilities for Burmese students to study abroad. So we've actually worked with them a number of other times as well. So I think it is, in a way, a nice way for us to really begin to think about the tragedy itself, but also how do you actually respond to such a huge, huge calamity that has faced the nation of Burma. I'm pleased to tell you that this program is co-organized once again with Open Society Institute, and I'm delighted that Maureen, our friend, is right here. And we are also delighted to welcome listeners who are joining us via live video webcast. So welcome, all of you, wherever you are. Our program today focuses on the ongoing humanitarian crisis in Burma following Cyclone Nargis, which, according to latest estimates, has left more than 134,000 people dead or missing and affected 2.5 million survivors. We feel that this kind of a program is really very important, even as the news about the cyclone and about Burma are gradually receding from the press, that this is exactly the time that we need to take a look back, step back, and see the implications of this tragedy and where we are headed. This is really part of a series of events on Burma that we have been doing here at the Asia Society. We have previously looked at human rights and public health-related issues in the country. We also held an emergency town hall meeting immediately following the Burmese junta's violent crackdown on thousands of monks and political activists. We also actually assembled more recently a panel of experts to examine efforts to advance national reconciliation in Burma. I should also mention that most of these programs are actually also available on our website around a number of different kinds of video and webcasts. So I do hope that even if you didn't come to the programs, that you will check out the website to get a sense of the details with which we have been committed to bring to you the information about Burma. This morning, We're joined by a distinguished panel of individuals, two of whom have just returned from Burma. Also joining us will be a volunteer local relief worker who will talk to us by telephone from inside Burma to provide an on-the-ground account of the situation. Hello?
Hello.
Yes. Is that Henyatta?
It is. Vishaka, how are you?
Hi, how are you? Thank you so much.
I'm fine. Hear your voice.
It's great to hear your voice from Macedonia.
Thank you.
Thank you. I should just say that our colleague from Burma, due to security reasons, will remain anonymous. We've also asked each one of our speakers and panelists to talk about recent developments in the country, including the international humanitarian response to meet the most urgent challenges as well as longer-term recovery efforts. Introducing the panel and moderating and presiding over the discussion will be George Biddle. George is a senior vice president of IRC, that's the International Rescue Committee, a leading humanitarian organization that goes to war zones to rescue and rebuild lives. With a current budget of $250 million and a worldwide staff of over 10,000 people, the IRC operates programs in 25 countries around the world and 24 cities across the United States, directly aiding over 15 million displaced and war-affected individuals. And this was just in 2006. He previously was, and that's Mr. Biddle, was the vice president of the International Crisis Group and president of the Washington-based Institute for Central American Studies, a nonprofit organization that he founded in 1989 to assist post-Cold War Central America in its transition from violent conflict to peace and democracy. Before I turn the microphone over to Mr. Biddle to introduce the panelists, I would also like to encourage you to visit our website at www.asiasociety.org for information about upcoming Asia Society programs and more recent events. Of course, the best way to stay informed about all that we do is to join us. So a quick plug on membership, which is all on your seats. And please, if you're not a member, do join us. I would also just like to have two other quick announcements. One is, please turn off your cell phones. And secondly, also, if you may, please take a few moments to fill out the audience survey so that we can get feedback on future programs from all of you. And staff members will be available to pick them up as you leave the program. And for those who are joining us via webcast, we'd like you to participate in the Q&A session that will follow the panelists' remarks. So please email your questions to moderator at asiasociety.org. Now, please join me in welcoming Mr. George Biddle.
Thank you, Vishaka, and let me also extend my thanks to the Asia Society and to the Open Society Institute for hosting this very important discussion this morning. I think these pictures, drawings that the kids in the Delta have shared with us really brings home the devastating impact of this cyclone and the challenges that we all in the international community face in addressing it. We are very fortunate to have such a distinguished and knowledgeable panel here to discuss this topic this morning, and particularly appreciative of Administrator Ford for joining us via Macedonia. Obviously, the connection is very clear, so we'll really be able to hear her. I'd like to introduce each of the panelists in the order in which they will speak. Following the interventions by each of the panelists, as well as the relief worker on the ground, we will then move to a question and answer session. Just want to state at the outset, if you do have a question, I'd very much like it if you would introduce yourself, identify the organization or institution you're affiliated with, and make sure that you have a microphone as well. Sir John Holmes is the UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator, a position he assumed in 2007. Prior to joining the United Nations, he was British Ambassador to France, a post he held since October 2001. A career diplomat, he joined the Foreign and Commonwealth Office in 1973 and has served in a wide range of roles. In London in 1978, he dealt with Lebanon and the Middle East peace process before being appointed private secretary to the British Foreign Secretary in 1982, covering the Middle East, Asia, Latin America. In 1991, he went to India as political, then economic and commercial counselor at the British High Commission in New Delhi, supervising the British aid program as well as economic and commercial issues. He also served as the private secretary and diplomatic advisor to Prime Minister Tony Blair from 1997 to 99 before becoming principal private secretary. He was the British G8 Sherpa during the time, including during the British G8 presidency of 1998. He was awarded a knighthood in 1999 primarily for his role in the Northern Ireland peace process and the Good Friday peace agreement. The Honorable Henrietta Fore is the administrator of the U.S. Agency for International Development and the director of U.S. Foreign Assistance. As the first female administrator of USAID, she is responsible for managing U.S. foreign assistance, including support to countries recovering from disaster, trying to escape poverty, and engaging in democratic reforms. She oversees a staff of approximately 8,000 individuals. Immediately prior to her confirmation at USAID, she served as Undersecretary of State for Management, a position she held beginning in August of 2005. Prior to this appointment, she served as the 37th Director of the United States Mint in the Department of Treasury, and she was also a presidential appointee at the U.S. Agency for International Development from 1989 to 1993, serving in a variety of positions. Ms. Fore has also held leadership positions in numerous international nonprofit organizations, including the Center for Strategic and International Studies, the Aspen Institute, the Asia Society, the Asia Foundation, and the Institute of the Americas. Our last panelist, Ambassador Vanu Gopalamenon, presented his credentials as Singapore's permanent representative to the United Nations in New York in September 2004. Before assuming his post in New York, he was Singapore's permanent representative and ambassador to the United Nations in Geneva and the World Trade Organization, and concurrently accredited at that time to be Singapore's ambassador to the Republic of Turkey, which he held from 2001 to 2004. Ambassador Menon joined the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in June 1985. He served as first secretary in the Singapore mission to the United Nations in New York from 1988 to April 1991, and as counselor and later minister counselor in the Singapore High Commission in Kuala Lumpur from November 94 to November 1997. On his return to ministry headquarters, he was appointed senior deputy at the Policy and Planning Analysis Directorate, and later he became its full-time director in 1998 and was concurrently, from 2000 to 2001, Singapore's chief negotiator for the Singapore-Australia Free Trade Agreement. He was also chairman of the World Trade Organization's Council for TRIPS from 2003 to 2004. Obviously, an enormous amount of experience in dealing with the issues that we will address today from each of the panelists and their background. So without further ado, I'd like to pass the microphone to Sir John Holmes to begin our discussion today. Thank you.
Thank you very much, George, and thank you for reminding everybody just how long I've been around. Thank you also for the invitation to talk about the crisis in Myanmar. What I thought I'd try to do is, first of all, gallop through some of the main points of what has happened, because I think it's important to be clear about what's happened and what has not happened, because I'm not sure the media coverage has always got that quite right. And then I'll finish up with a couple of reflections about what's happened. I think the first thing to say is this was a particularly difficult natural disaster to deal with, not only because of its severity and the nature and inaccessibility of the terrain where it happened down in the delta, but also because we were dealing with a government and a people which had no recent experience of disasters of this magnitude. And also, of course, there's a political angle too. We were dealing with a government which was politically isolated and therefore rather suspicious of the outside world. It was clear very quickly that we were dealing with a major catastrophe. As Vishaka said, more than 130,000 dead, and that could even turn out to be more than that. And the extent of the devastation from, not so much from the cyclone itself, but from the tidal surge which accompanied it, was really quite astonishing. And when I toured the area a couple of times by helicopter, where the tidal surge had swept up the delta, there was virtually nothing left in some places. You could see where the houses had been, but that was about all, which explains the enormous death toll which went with it. The international community, including the UN, obviously offered our help immediately as soon as the extent of the damage became clear, to support national efforts, as we always do in such cases. And the government of Myanmar almost immediately said that they would welcome outside assistance, outside aid and outside financial assistance, recognising that they simply wouldn't be able to cope alone with a disaster of this magnitude. And aid did begin to arrive in the first few days. We launched a flash appeal at the UN 1 week after the disaster, asking for $201 million. And the government of Madagascar said at that point and made clear that they would welcome help from any quarter, from any country, including, for example, the United States. And that's at that point that the C-130 flight program began from the US. There's been over 100 flights, which is a really remarkable aid effort in the circumstances. But there was one exception from that, from which, regrettably, the government have not wavered, which that was they didn't want any military vessels in their ports or any military helicopters to help them. Meanwhile, obviously, there was a national assistance effort underway, including military as well as civilian efforts. The government appointed ministers to supervise the efforts in each area, and they were stationed down there. They organised the private sector as well, assigning sectors to major companies. The Myanmar Red Cross played a very major role in this. And then, of course, there were very extensive local efforts from the monasteries and from other local citizens, which continue to this day as well. And all this was in addition to the international efforts we were trying to mobilise. Now, there are some doubts about how effective all the national effort was, and certainly there was a lack of systematic and well-coordinated approach and a lack of good information about who was being reached, and that's a problem we're still grappling with. The government also appeared at times to be a little bit quick to say that the relief phase was over and they were moving on to reconstruction, although I think there was a certain degree of misunderstanding about that, about the difference between rescue and relief. In any case, it quickly became clear that we did have, despite the welcome for aid in principle and the arrival of international aid, we did have one significant problem, which was the reluctance of the government to see international relief workers coming into the country in any numbers, and in particular getting access to the worst affected areas down in the delta in any numbers. And that meant we had to rely on the international organisations, both the UN and the Red Cross and the NGOs had to rely heavily on their local staff. The local staff, I think, did a heroic job down there, but there were clearly limits to their energy and limits to their experience in dealing with a crisis of this kind in the absence of the kind of expert, experienced international staff who would expect to deploy in any other disaster of this kind. And there was also reluctance on the part of the government to see outside assets being used, such as helicopters, particularly military helicopters, but in the first place, even civilian assets like helicopters too, and even offers from their ASEAN neighbours were refused in the initial stages. So this has been a key focus of the discussions we've been having with the government in the last 3 or 4 weeks to try to persuade them to allow in international relief workers both into the country and into the most affected areas, and to allow the international community to provide assets which would help actually distribute the aid. And this is obviously a slightly odd situation where we're, in effect, asking the government to allow us to help them more in a natural disaster in ways that we do virtually everywhere else in the world. But that has been the situation we have faced for reasons which perhaps you can understand. And that was what led to my own visit and that of the Secretary-General a couple of weeks ago. We were basing ourselves very much on the principle of keeping the humanitarian aspects totally separate from the political aspects, while also making clear to the government of Myanmar that unless there was rapid progress in the kind of areas we were talking about, the kind of access we were talking about, politicisation of the situation of the kind that they feared would become much more likely. Now, I won't go into the details of the visits, but suffice it to say that at the end of those visits, we did achieve agreement at the highest level from Senior General Tan Shui, after significant efforts at lower levels, that the government would allow international workers access into the country through granting of visas more rapidly and access to the most affected areas down in the delta. There was also agreement that the World Food Programme could charter some civilian helicopters and use those. And there was also agreement, which is important, and I'll come back to this, to set up a trilateral coordination mechanism, including the government, the UN and ASEAN, ASEAN acting as a bridge, as it were, between the wider international community and the government. So 2 weeks after those visits, how are we actually doing? I think we have made progress, even though that's been slower than we would like, and it still remains a struggle with some of the bureaucratic requirements. They are bureaucratic problems, I think, at the moment, rather than issues of actual principle. So UN staff, international relief staff, are getting into the Delta in reasonable numbers, although we're not having as much success as we would like in getting agreement for them to be based down there. The situation is a little bit less clear for the international NGOs and the International Red Cross, but here too I think we are moving forward in the right direction, even if rather slowly. The helicopters I mentioned from the World Food Programme are now beginning to operate properly. Six are now operating, moving people and goods around, and four more should be doing the same in the next day or two. And, of course, there are hundreds of medical staff from the immediate neighbours, Myanmar's immediate neighbours, and ASEAN countries, which have been operating down in the Delta for some time now. So how is the relief operation itself actually going? We estimate that the international relief efforts, and together with those of the Myanmar Red Cross, we've reached something like 1.3 million or more than that out of the 2.4 million we thought were badly affected. And the national effort, that is the government efforts, the private sector effort, and individual efforts, have no doubt reached many more than that 1.3 million, although we have no accurate information about that, and there could well be an overlap between the figures I'm talking about, the 1.3 million I'm talking about, and the others that have been reached by others. So we've reached a significant number of people. We're not doing well enough yet. And there isn't yet a fully effective relief pipeline, I would say, in terms of a reliable flow of food for the future. I'm not talking about right now. And in particular, for example, there are problems about shelter goods, tarpaulins, plastic sheeting, because that's one of the major needs, given that so many houses were simply destroyed. We also need more funding from the international community. The flash appeal I mentioned for $201 million is two-thirds funded at the moment. We've got about $140 million, but we still need more, and I hope that the donor community will continue to be generous. There may be some remote villages right down in the south of the Delta that we've not reached at all, but I think most areas have been reached by somebody, so we're beginning to get a better impression of the situation on the ground. What we've found so far is no evidence of unusual disease cases. The epidemic we feared at one stage does not seem to have happened, at least so far. I mean, there are plenty of eyes and ears on the ground, so I think we would be aware of that. And we haven't found any evidence of starvation as such, although, of course, hunger and malnutrition are certainly there. Indeed, they were there before the cyclone struck. So there are plenty of problems about reaching people with the right kind of consistent aid. The logistics remain very difficult. Many communities are only accessible by boat and by very small boats. That really poses a significant problem. But at least there is no evidence so far of the second wave of deaths that we and many others feared. People perhaps are more resilient and more inclined to move when they have problems than we sometimes give them credit for. Nevertheless, as I say, the aid operation is not in a satisfactory situation yet. And there are concerns which we are raising with the government about, for example, forced relocations from camps and from settlements, and or even forced labour. Again, we have no solid evidence of that, but there are stories which are sufficiently worrying that we are raising them with the government. There is also a new assessment underway to look at both the relief needs and the longer-term reconstruction needs. This is a major effort by about 220 people from the government, from the UN and from ASEAN. That started literally yesterday. And today, and the idea is to provide the kind of reliable information about what's needed now and what's needed in the future that we've been lacking so far. And it's very important in that respect to mention the ASEAN role again. The cooperation between the UN and ASEAN has been extremely good throughout this, and they are acting as a very important resource and, as I say, a very important bridge between the government and the wider international community. Let me just conclude with a few reflections. We still face enormous challenges, not only in the relief phase, but also in the reconstruction phase. And one of the things we have to do is to make sure that we build back better. What that means is, in particular, we need to make sure that there are the kind of provisions against disasters of this kind in future, the kind of disaster risk reduction measures which Bangladesh, for example, has introduced with such success in rather similar circumstances. So there are evacuation methods, there are shelters, there are embankments, there are places for people to go, and people know what they need to do when a disaster like this happens. That's extremely important, because if you look at the difference in the death tolls between Cyclone Sidr in Bangladesh in November and Cyclone Nargis in Myanmar, you can see the difference between 4,000 deaths and 130,000 deaths, and that's largely, not entirely, but largely due to better preparation and better disaster risk reduction measures. Was there an alternative to the approach of working with the Myanmar government in circumstances like this, despite all the many frustrations? Could the international community or the Security Council have somehow forced the government of Myanmar to be more cooperative? Could military operations, airdrops or whatever, have been used successfully in these circumstances, as many suggested at some point? Personally, I don't believe there was a realistic alternative, and I've never seen a realistic alternative to the approach we pursued spelled out by anybody. Nor have I met anyone engaged in the operation on the ground who thought that there was an alternative which could actually have helped those most in need on the ground, in other words, the victims of the cyclone. How could sanctions, if they could have been agreed by the Security Council, which they would not have been, but how could they, even if they had been agreed, have helped in the short term? It's not clear to me. How could confrontation and the likely withdrawal of all government cooperation, if we'd gone for a route of confrontation, actually have contributed to the welfare of those on the ground? Again, it's not clear to me that they would. We've seen a lot of passionate and understandable talk about that, but that itself is not enough. That's not to say that there can never be a role for humanitarian intervention, or that the responsibility to protect is necessarily automatically and forever inapplicable to natural disasters, even if it was not devised for this context. But it seems to me that it would have to be absolutely the last resort before there could be any question of overriding national sovereignty in this kind of way. And there would have to be extremely good evidence before you could even start to contemplate such a thing, and exhaustion of all the possible alternatives of persuasion and help. And all those were lacking in this case when these ideas were raised right at the beginning. A final thought. Major natural disasters always leave a mark on countries, and not just a mark on the landscape. And sometimes they create new opportunities. So could the current degree of engagement between the government of Myanmar and the international community, and the, to some extent at least, encouraging signs of readiness to cooperate with the international community, despite all the problems I've mentioned, could this have a significance beyond the immediate humanitarian operation, if both sides wanted it to? It's not really for me to say and to delve into the political aspects of that, but it certainly shouldn't be ruled out. And everyone is also aware that once the immediate humanitarian crisis is over, the political issues of democratisation and the good office's mission of Ibrahim Gambari will certainly be back on the agenda. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ambassador Holmes. Ms. Four, can you hear us in Macedonia?
I can. Thank you, George.
Please, if you'd like to join us and deliver your remarks now, that would be terrific. And again, thank you for being able to join us at such a long distance.
Well, thank you, George. And George, am I coming through clearly?
Perfectly.
All right, good. Well, then, good morning to everyone. I wish I were there. And to my friends, Vishaka and you, George, and Sir John, to the ambassador and our colleague from Burma, I also want to thank you for allowing me to come in from Skopje in Macedonia. The Asia Society has been such a strong leader in Asia in promoting and strengthening relationships between the United States and Asia that one of the areas we should not lose sight of is that their extensive relationship with Burma has been particularly critical following May's devastating cyclone. All of us must begin with our deepest condolences to the people of Burma. The extent of the devastation that all of you have outlined that was caused by Cyclone Nargis is vast. The relief efforts require a cooperation and a coordination of the entire international humanitarian community. And I will continue to mention that we need to continue to carry a sense of urgency and importance of this humanitarian disaster. The United States Agency for International Development has been actively involved in humanitarian assistance efforts in Burma and greatly appreciates the hard work of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, the United Nations, and so many other partners. Together, we are coordinating an international response to the crisis. We are also working with the government of Burma to allow relief workers full access to the 2.4 million or thereabouts cyclone-affected individuals, many of whom we also believe, along with Sir John, have not received any aid because of access constraints. But much more needs to be done, and the United States remains ready to help. We are pursuing a concrete five-part plan to save lives and to alleviate suffering of the Burmese people. This plan includes transporting emergency relief commodities, supporting international coordination mechanisms, continued advocating for access to the Burmese people, prepositioning of human and material assets as appropriate, and providing funding for humanitarian partners. I would just briefly like to describe how this plan is already underway and what we see ahead. First, the United States government has transported emergency relief commodities valued at $35.1 million. These commodities have been consigned directly to international organizations, to UN agencies, and non-governmental organizations and partners. All have reported that these relief commodities are having a significant and positive impact. The United States government has flown a total of 121 flights to transport relief commodities funded by governmental and non-governmental donors. I arrived to Bangkok shortly after the cyclone hit to accompany our first United States government flight carrying relief commodities into Rangoon. The commodities are critical to address the crisis, but they are only a first step. Cyclone-affected populations continue to desperately need shelter, medical assistance, food, and safe drinking water. Therefore, the second part of our plan focuses on supporting a coordination mechanism by which the international community can assess needs and deliver assistance quickly and effectively. The scope and scale of this disaster requires that such coordination and the technical expertise offered by many governments and donors. In my conversations with the international humanitarian community in Bangkok and in Washington, it has been clear that all of us desire to work together provide aid quickly and effectively to those in need. In the past few weeks, we have made strides in building a coordination mechanism. The Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN, is providing leadership in coordinating the international community. UN staff are finally receiving visas from the government of Burma to enter the country, and coordination is happening, and we are continuously building on those successes. However, aid agencies continue to report limitations on their access to populations, and most international aid workers remain confined to Rangoon City. This leaves Burmese staff, some of whom also lost their homes and loved ones, to carry on this enormous task of getting aid to those in need. Without question, they are stretched too thin. Part three of our plan is urging Burmese authorities to allow relief workers full access to cyclone-affected areas. We also urge Burmese authorities to continue issuing visas to international aid experts, including specialists of our USAID Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance. I know Secretary General Ban Ki-moon and UN Undersecretary John Holmes are also urging the government of Burma to allow humanitarian access to affected areas, and this is helpful. As we slowly gain access to assist the Burmese people, we are simultaneously implementing the next part of our plan. Part four is to preposition both human and material assets as appropriate. Our disaster assistance response team moved to Bangkok immediately after the cyclone to await visas to enter Burma. To date, our team leader and three members of the team have been allowed into the country. The United States Department of Defense has been poised to deliver commodities that sit on nearby planes and ships, and USAID's DART team has also made ready thousands of hygiene kits and water containers available for delivery once we receive access from the Burmese government. Efficient assistance requires readiness, and USAID is working diligently with our global partners to deliver support as soon as possible. Finally, part five of our plan is to provide direct funding to our humanitarian partners. USAID is funding UN agencies and trusted NGOs currently operating in affected areas. We rely on our partners to help us understand the development and humanitarian needs and provide appropriate aid to those who need it. As of June 6th, the United States government has provided more than $35.1 million to our international partners to fund relief commodities and implement life-saving assistance programs to Burma. The United States takes seriously its moral obligation to provide life-saving assistance for disaster-affected populations and is prepared to provide more funding as full and accurate needs assessments are completed. This is a disaster of immense proportions with serious consequences for Burma. Historical experience shows that even the best prepared country facing a disaster of this magnitude requires major international assistance. And USAID continues to support the Burmese people through the five-part plan I briefly described, transporting emergency relief commodities, supporting international coordination efforts, urging the Burmese government to issue visas to experts and aid workers, pre-positioning of assets, and funding our NGO and UN partners. We closely monitor reports that indicate deteriorations in the health or food security situation. We are working to ensure the relief supplies and services reach those who need them. But above all, I want to emphasize the United States government remains ready to help. We continue to stand by the people of Burma at this difficult time, but all of us in the audience and on the line, we all need to carry a sense of urgency. Thank you.
Thank you, Henrietta. I understand you're going to be able to join us for the duration of the meeting. Is that correct?
I plan to, so I'm going to do my best.
Great. Well, thank you very much. We'll turn to our next speaker, Ambassador Menon, and when we get to the Q&A, I'll ask the audience to direct any questions to you at the outset.
Very good. Thank you, George.
Thank you.
I would like to thank Asia Society for inviting me this morning, and Vishanka Desai for the opening remarks, and George for being the moderator for this morning session. Let me begin by saying that I speak in my national capacity and not as ASEAN chairman. In my national capacity, I mean as the ambassador of Singapore, not Myanmar. All of you are familiar with the tragic events in Myanmar over the past 1 month. John Holmes and Henrietta Fore have already spoken about the humanitarian and relief efforts. I will try to provide a sense of the role ASEAN has played in assisting the people of Myanmar. ASEAN has tried to avoid ideology and polemics. We have chosen to be pragmatic and to focus on getting as much assistance into Myanmar as possible. This has meant working with Myanmar. Speaking of which, I'm not here to defend Myanmar. I think we should have the courtesy of calling the country by its proper name. Referring to it by a colonial-era appellation is self-indulgent. It also does not help build trust or cooperative relations. Building trust is what we should aim to do. When Cyclone Nargis struck, the ASEAN member states immediately offered assistance to Myanmar. This included several million dollars in cash and kind and the dispatch of disaster assistance teams, doctors and supplies. Singapore, for example, offered heavy-lift Chinook helicopters, the same type of aircraft that helped in Hurricane Katrina rescue efforts. Singapore, Thailand, and the Philippines all offered medical teams. Unfortunately, the Myanmar authorities did not take up these offers. They claimed that they did not need relief personnel or assets because they had the situation under control. But it was clear to ASEAN that Myanmar needed more help given the scale of disaster and human suffering. It was therefore disappointing to us that our initial offers were not taken up. But we persisted. At the same time, the international community was doing the same. But there was a bit of an impasse given the distinct lack of trust between Myanmar and the international community, a perception exacerbated by countries that threatened Security Council action and other forms of intervention. These threats did little to help encourage cooperation. The Myanmar authorities were reluctant to permit international experts and relief teams to enter the country. Despite all these obstacles, supplies were still coming in. although some offers were rejected. For example, the Myanmar government refused to allow aid from the French and US naval vessels anchored off the coast, but accepted airlifted aid from the US and other countries. 2 weeks into the disaster, suffering continued to be acute. We needed to break the impasse and build bridges. This is why ASEAN convened the special foreign ministers meeting on the 19th of May. This event was an ASEAN-only affair because we needed Myanmar to be comfortable and to engage ASEAN meaningfully. There were candid exchanges of views. Myanmar explained its view. The other ASEAN countries expressed their concerns, the key point being that the status quo was untenable in terms of humanitarian responsibility. We should not let politics and mutual suspicions block the effective disbursement of aid. The results of the meeting were positive. Myanmar felt more comfortable with ASEAN's involvement. Myanmar agreed to immediately accept medical teams from ASEAN. Myanmar also agreed to establish an ASEAN-led coordinating mechanism to distribute aid and coordinate relief efforts. This task force, led by ASEAN Secretary General Surin Pitsuan, will help facilitate the effective distribution of assistance from the international community and expedite the deployment of relief personnel. Additionally, a tripartite core group, TCG, of ASEAN, OCHA, and Myanmar and the Myanmar authorities will support efforts of the task force. The TCG recently agreed to dispatch 200 Emergency Rapid Assessment Team, IRAT, personnel from the 5th of June. The IRAT members will be supported by helicopters of the World Food Programme and are expected to report to the TCG by mid-June. Another outcome was a joint ASEAN-UN pledging conference in Yangon, which took place on the 25th of May. This resulted in more than $50 million of much-needed pledges towards the relief effort. But this was less about the pledges and more about building trust between Myanmar and the international community. In fact, that was ASEAN's goal. The impasse before was due to mutual distrust and a misunderstanding. ASEAN had to interpose itself into the equation because Myanmar felt more comfortable with us being involved. Indeed, just before the pledging conference, Senior General Tan Shwe made a commitment to the Secretary General of the United Nations, Mr. Ban Ki-moon, that Myanmar would accept all genuine relief workers as long as they applied for visas. This promise was repeated at the pledging conference by the Prime Minister of Myanmar. And there has been progress on this front since the conclusion of the pledging conference. But we look forward to seeing Myanmar continue this cooperation and to more international relief efforts, relief workers gaining entry into Myanmar to help the victims. The current situation is still not ideal, but nonetheless an improvement. There remain obstacles to overcome on the ground to ensure that aid is disbursed quickly and effectively. From the humanitarian standpoint, every obstacle means more avoidable casualties and more unconscionable human suffering. The frustration of the international community at Myanmar's refusal to let them act faster and do more is understandable. We share that frustration. But at the same time, we need to understand the perspective of Myanmar's domestic politics. The military leaders know that foreign aid will help, but they fear the political consequence of opening up the disaster zone to international aid teams. These might show up their own incapacity and undermine their credibility and legitimacy. They're suspicious of humanitarian aid serving as a camouflage for regime change, a perception that is not entirely unreasonable when some countries have talked about invoking responsibility to protect and mounting relief operations without host government permission. I'm not here to defend Myanmar, but I think we need to understand their perspective if we want to find the best way to approach this humanitarian effort. It is easy to get frustrated, it is easy to be critical, but what alternative is there to working with the authorities if you want a successful relief effort? We cannot conduct an effective relief operation without the consent of the Myanmars. Even Defence Secretary Robert Gates thinks so. Airdropping supplies and docking ships without permission is not feasible. This violates Myanmar's sovereignty. Does this encourage cooperation or does it make the Myanmars close their borders? I think we need to be realistic. Alas, there's only so much ASEAN can do to help build bridges of trust. Can we collectively do more? Yes. I'm sure the entire international community feels this way. For now, we seem to be heading in the right direction. But Myanmar needs to live up to its promises. The international community should also keep its eye on the humanitarian effort and not try to politicize the situation. What is important is to focus on doing good for the people of Myanmar. Myanmar has to play its part too. It should not be a case of one step forward and two steps back. Any backtracking would be a serious blow to our confidence in our ability to work with Myanmar. For ASEAN, it would call into question how Myanmar views the organization. Indeed, it would also lead to questions about how ASEAN should view Myanmar. But for now, let us focus on getting the aid to the people of Myanmar who need it most. Thank you.
Thank you, Ambassador Menon. Are we able to go to the field now and connect with the relief worker on the ground? Are you able to hear us? Do we? Yes. Hello. This is George Biddle at the Asia Society. Are you able to hear us on the ground? We're going to call back. Okay. So could I ask our two panelists who are present, Sir John and Ambassador Menon, to join us here on stage? Yeah, I'm going to stand here. I think that'll be easier. So whichever seat you most prefer. Well, I think I'll take the prerogative as the moderator to ask the first question. I think one of the things that many of us in the humanitarian community are most concerned about is one of the things that Sir John mentioned. We know we have reached approximately 1.3 million of the estimated 2.4 million who have been affected by this crisis. But we don't really have a full picture of what the 1.1 million are experiencing. So I'd like to ask both of our panelists if they are truly hopeful that the current tripartite assessment effort will be successful in reaching all parts of the country, and do we really have a clear understanding whether those areas in the western part of the Delta are not beginning to experience the early indications of any waterborne disease epidemics, which is obviously the most frightening aspect in the early term of a crisis. I maybe turn to Sir John initially to see what his reaction to this is. And
hello?
Also to, can you hear us on the ground? This is George Biddle at the Asia Society. Are you able to hear me? No. We're going to come back to that. We'll keep trying. This is not an easy thing to do, as you know. But in the interim, we'll turn to Sir John for his first reactions. And, of course, Henrietta, if you have a reaction to that question, we would obviously be delighted to hear from you as well.
Well, thank you, George. I mean, it is obviously the key question. And all the numbers should, as always in these circumstances, be treated with a certain amount of suspicion. I mean,
we think 2.4 million people were badly affected, but you can cut those numbers other ways if you choose.
We're reasonably confident we've reached 1.3. Is it too close? Is that better? No? Yes? More? I didn't put it on, by the way. It's not mine. How about that?
Just go a little bit higher.
Okay? How about that? Does that sound right? No.
Okay. Apologize for the slight technical difficulties. We'll work this out.
I could shout.
Yeah. Why don't? Yeah, I think. Yeah. If.
Let me just. Should I just take that out of the way for the moment?
I think it was working there, actually. Yeah. Sorry about that.
Right. What I was trying to say was that we should treat all the numbers with a little bit of suspicion, because although we're talking about 2.4 million affected and we've reached 1.3 million, these are not scientific figures as we would like. But we're reasonably confident that we've reached 1.3 million people with something, some items of aid, and we've got some idea what condition they're in. And as I was trying to say, that 1.3 million is not all the people who've been reached, because that doesn't take any account of what the national aid effort and the commercial effort and the private effort, which is obviously important in these circumstances, it takes no account of that. So, you know, if you add those two figures together, we ought to be getting close to most people being reached with something. Nevertheless, what we do fear is that there are still some people right in the southwest of the Delta whose condition we're not sure of. I think most people, most areas have been visited by somebody, so I don't think there's huge numbers of people out there which we know nothing about. Our best guess at the moment is that, and there are a lot of medical teams around, both from ASEAN and elsewhere, and a lot of, and from the national government, and from international NGOs, and from the World Health Organization, and UNICEF. So medical teams are very present, and even though a lot of the health infrastructure was destroyed by the cyclone, I think there are a lot of eyes and ears down there. If there were really serious problems of new communicable diseases from the situation people are living in, I think we'd know about it. And it hasn't happened so far, which is not to say it won't happen or can't happen, but it hasn't happened so far. Similarly, we haven't found any evidence, of starvation. There is malnutrition. Rates of child malnutrition in that part of Myanmar were already significant, above danger levels in some cases. We haven't found any big change in that in the studies we've done so far, but again, they're fairly preliminary studies. What we do hope is that this assessment, and there's a large number of people, I think, as I say, about 220 people fanning out, will reach everywhere and will be able to give us a much better picture. Unfortunately, that will not be available very quickly, because it will take a number of weeks to get all those visits done, to get all that data collected and assembled and analysed. But in the meantime, we are collecting more and more, so we are able to be, you know, more and more confident that while the aid operation, you know, is still struggling in some ways, the sense of urgency which Henrietta Fore talked about has to be there. Nevertheless, we are not facing a catastrophic situation at the moment, and I hope we will not face one in the future.
Thank you, Sir John. Do either Ambassador Menon or Ms. Fore have anything to add to that?
Well, I think John has answered the question, I think, very comprehensively, and I think all I can say is there has been progress on the ground, especially following the ASEAN foreign ministers' meeting and the pledging conference held in Myanmar. Since then, I think the Myanmar authorities have actually been far more cooperative than before. They've been issuing visas to almost all the relief aid workers that want to go into Myanmar. In fact, I was struck by a comment which the Secretary of State for International Development of the UK Foreign and Commonwealth Office, Douglas Alexander, made in the House of Commons on the 3rd of June. And he said, and I quote, "Since the conference, there has been some improvement in access. No visas have been refused to the UN or international NGO personnel in the last 7 days. The Myanmar Red Cross has been able to scale up its operations substantially in the Delta. 5 international medical teams from countries in the region are now providing support to national healthcare staff in the Delta. A DFID team managed to travel to the Irrawaddy Delta on the 29th of May. There are problems, but the point is there has been progress." I mean, and then I think that's the point that I think John was trying to make, and I agree with him. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to open it up to the audience. We do have an online question, which I'll turn to in a minute, but I thought I'd start with our audience here. If I can just ask you to identify yourself and your organization, and please take the mic. Yes, this gentleman right here in the front.
Yes, I'm Harold Church, and I work at Polytechnic University. Just a brief factual question. When you're talking about the Southwest Delta region, could you just name the districts or something so I can find it on the map?
You might test my geographical knowledge at that point. One of the main affected townships is Labuta, which is down in the southwest delta. And there's an island whose name I can't remember, right in the southwest. There's Bogali, I think I should pronounce it, which is also very, very key. And it's the areas south of there which were worst affected by this enormous 15-foot tidal surge which surged up the delta. What you have to understand is it's completely flat. There was no relief whatsoever for 20 or 30 miles from the sea inwards. So this was like a tsunami, only much more long-lasting and much worse in its effects, because it went inland much, much further than the tsunami did in most places.
George, may I add in a comment?
Yes, please do, Henrietta.
If I may back up what my colleagues have said, that we have not seen in that region any outbreak of malaria or cholera that we can see. But what we are most concerned about is that when we reach a population with assistance, it can be uneven. So it may be that we can reach them with water, but they have no food, or that we reach them with food, but they have no cooking pot, or we reach them with a cooking pot, but they have no shelter, and on it goes, so that it's important that we try to reach them with a relief package, and our greatest concern is for children because they have the least ability to deal with dehydration and disease and lack of food. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have another question? Yes.
Amy Stone, freelance writer. If I may, two brief questions, just in terms of what's happening in Yangon. We haven't heard anything from Aung San Suu Kyi, as far as I know, other than that the government has sentenced her to another year under house arrest, so I wonder whether she's being heard from at all. And then my other question was in terms of our being able to support local non-governmental outreach. Maureen Ong Twin had said that Avaaz was effective in terms of getting aid to monks who were somehow getting aid to people in need. And can you comment on that, please?
If I can ask the panelists to hold off for one moment, and I understand we do have a connection to the field. I want to take advantage of it while we have it. So if we could come back to your question. This is George Biddle at the Asia Society. Can you hear me on the ground?
Yes.
Would you be willing to share with us over the next five?
Yeah.
Thank you very much. We're delighted to have you. Thank you very much.
Yes. Can you hear me?
We can.
Hey, hello, everybody. Good morning. Actually, real time in Rangoon is now 8 o'clock in the evening. Okay, thank you for inviting me to this special event. I am one of the volunteer workers in relief groups which were spontaneously emerged locally after the cyclone Nargis. We are based in Rangoon and provided relief works in selected townships in disaster-stricken areas such as Shibokan in North Oklapa, Chimindang, Alone, Komu, Tella in Rangoon Division, and Bukele, Labuda, and Didier in Irrawaddy Division. Our group comprises businessmen, jewelry shop owners, medical doctors, publishers, college students, Buddhist monks, Rangoon's current ethnic groups, and volunteers from local community-based organizations. There may be hundreds or thousands of such groups, individual donors, film star groups, film villain groups, Jotu's Funeral Service Assistant Group, Saganas Group, IT lovers, businessmen, Buddhist monks, and other religious leaders, private medical doctors, NLD party members, and many more. Donations have been pouring in for these groups because people trust in more on local charity groups than on those formed by the authorities such as USDA, Union Solidarity, Union State Solidarity Association, or Myanmar Women Affairs, etc. Some business partners with the regime, such as Two Trading Company, Airbagan, Zikaba, etc., were also doing relief work in cooperation with higher authorities. We began our relief work on May the 3rd by cutting trees and clearing the streets in cooperation with Buddhist monks. We traveled to Labrador, Bugale, Komu, Shipaukan, Chimidan Opposite Bank, and Diria Townships. Our most recent trip was on the 5th of June. We got to two villages, Akeyama and Akechampir in Diria Township, which is only 50 miles away from Rangoon, but it is far in desert area leading to the Andaman Sea. Access to these villages is only by waterway from Diria. It takes 2-hour motor drive from Rangoon and 3-hour boat ride from Diria. One village suffers 300 people dead, but 600 people are still alive, including 150 children. Another village lost 800 people, and 1,500 remained alive during the cyclone. Two village primary schools have totally been collapsed. Almost all of the cattle lost in cyclone. Most villagers were fishermen, some were farmers. They were taken care of by a Buddhist monk from Aletoya Village Monastery. People shared shelter in some repair houses and in a village monastery. Many houses have been repaired with local thatched leaves, but some houses and bridges remained unrepaired yet. They got rainwater from drinking babas. 4 or 5 donor groups have already been there before our visit. Villages are still flooded. Some dead bodies remain stuck in the fields even after 1 month of cyclone. we could provide rice, edible oil, drinking water, clothes, rubber, slippers, tarpaulin, mosquito nets, and medical care. All children were provided snacks, school uniforms, rubber slippers, soaps, toothbrushes, and toothpaste. Villagers asked us to bring blankets if other donor groups may want to visit them. Villagers are with no relief camp, no official or authorities relief supply, no international intervention yet. Continued supply of food and water is urgently needed for their survival. These two villages are still in agony. To give a brief account of my relief work in other areas, in Labrador, I found victims were kept very congested. Three families of 10 persons were placed in one tent. Victims had to continue labor. Victims had to contribute labor to pave the street in exchange for Russian relief materials supplied by officials. In Shepokan, I found victims' self-built tarpaulin-covered huts were too small to live. They were forcibly dispersed from small spacious state middle school compound just before Mr. Ban Ki-moon's visit. I found two foreigners are freely traveling in Labrador and Diriyah townships, but no foreign workers in villages. I saw relief officers of international organizations such as Marlin, Malteser, BMI, World Vision, World Concern, WFP, UNICEF, and UNDP, but employed by local staff only. I did not see any hovercraft, energy biscuits, foreign-made water or clothes, but I saw shelter boxes, blue tents, generators, water purifiers from international donors. Today afternoon, I saw one large helicopter first time flying over Rangoon, maybe possibly from WFP. Local volunteers' efforts were encouraging, but I found their works are not sufficient enough for the enormous extent of losses and damages. My idea is local donors, government, and international organizations must go hand in hand based on only on humanitarian imperative. One should not find fault and make restrictions with another in relief works. One should not argue in whether it is in rescue phase or rehabilitation phase. We must do our best for to get relief, the agony of Burmese people. Thank you very much to you all.
Thank you for joining us, and I think I can speak on behalf of everybody here.
Thank you.
We salute your bravery and dedication and persistence under exceedingly difficult and tragic circumstances, and we wish you well as you continue your efforts. Could I ask you one follow-on question? In terms of the difficulty in accessing these areas of the Delta, the supply chain, in order to get supplies out, some of the items that you were mentioning, how are you able to do that in the context of both procurement locally as well as the limited transportation vehicles which you have?
Yes, sir, we hired some big ship, big boat, and some locally motor vehicle, but it will be better. Relief items were carried by helicopters to these inaccessible areas. There are many areas that which can be accessible only by motorway, not by motor vehicle.
We wish you again continued good luck and support from the international community as we push out to support you in these efforts. So thank you for joining us. I don't know whether you're able to continue on the line, but we do appreciate your being able to do this. We know how difficult it is as well as how dangerous. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
I think we'll return to the question. If there is anyone who would like, do you know if the line will stay open? If there are any other... Okay, would anyone in the room like to address a question to the individual on the ground while we still have a connection there? And then we'll return to the question that we had prior to his joining us. Yes. So this is a question directed to you in the field. We're going to get a microphone to the questioner.
My name is Judy Dyer. I'm a private citizen. I was in Burma in December. Are your efforts being blocked by military on the ground? That's what I keep hearing in the news, that the military are blocking people from being at the monasteries or traveling on the roads.
Could you hear that question?
Where?
The question was, are your efforts in any way being hindered or blocked by the military on the ground?
Okay, as far as we are traveling now, we do not have nose hindrance or stop by the authority. But only thing is the search whether there's any foreigners in our car or in our group. When we respond that we do not have any foreign visitors or foreigners, they agree to allow them to proceed to our destination. And whenever we supply the relief items to the victims, the authority help us to give to get victims to get the right proportion of their relief material.
Thank you. That was very clear. We could hear you. I'm going to ask the audience if there's any other questions for you before we continue with the question that was asked before you joined us. Yes, gentleman, blue shirt.
Ed Krowitz was last in Burma about a year ago. I just want to ask the person in the field, what is the progress of the planting season? Have the farm, what implements do the farmers need? Can they start the planting season? And what would happen if they cannot continue on their planting?
Were you able to hear the question? It was asking about the planting season, whether it will proceed on a normal basis, and if not, what contingency plans exist?
For the rice plantation to regrow there, does it mean that the plantations can be grown in the field? It is the question.
Yes. Okay, I had trouble. Thank you very much. I'm sorry. I could not hear that. I'm sorry. Oh, okay. Yes, that was the question, if you could proceed. Sorry, I had trouble hearing you.
Yes. For this question, as far as I see there's no cattle in our relief. That's the areas that I have visited there. So cattle are scarce. And some area I found in the newspaper that international donors have provided some of the tiller machines to plow the fields. But fields are still flooded, and people are still surviving for the people are struggling for their life survival to get food, to get clothing, to repair the houses. So they are not they have no time to plow their fields now. So we have to wait for another 2 or 3 months. I think plantations will be in a later phase. The first phase is to rescue them, to survive them, to get them provide with food, clothing, shelters, everything. So they cannot they are still not considered when their plowing starts. No equipment, no supply, no seeds, no cattle. Very few are filled with salt water.
Thank you. That came in very clearly. Maybe a follow-on question to Sir John on this. In terms of the inability to move forward with the normal cultivation season, is there a concern about the food pipeline and the ability globally and the ability to make sure that the adequate supplies of food will get into the country over the next 6 months? I think June is primarily the time when a lot of the initial plantings occur. And with the salinization of the fields, as the gentleman mentioned, it becomes very difficult. That is also a long-term issue. It's not easy to clean out fields and get them to their normal ability in terms of supporting plantings. So with that in mind, do you have a concern about both the food pipeline on the one hand internationally and the ability to actually mobilize distribution efforts in country over the coming 6 months?
Well, clearly, as people have suggested, the ability to plant in the next month or two is crucial. The picture is going to be mixed. There are some areas where it's going to be impossible because villages have been destroyed and there were no water buffalo. And tillers may be provided, but probably not in sufficient numbers. Other areas where it's much less badly affected, where they probably will be able to get back and plant because the floodwaters are going down. And although the salinity of the water is a problem, but it is not impossible to plant rice in those circumstances, depending on the degree of salinity. But obviously one of the big reconstruction and rehabilitation concerns is precisely to get people those kind of supplies to enable the farmers and fishermen to restart their livelihoods as quickly as possible. But in a lot of cases that isn't going to be possible in time, so we are planning for feeding people for at least 6 months. That's why the World Food Programme need to have people stationed on the ground. They already have one member of staff stationed on the ground for a lengthy period, and they hope to get more. Because what they're doing is setting up 5 sub-base logistical bases in these towns like Lebuta and Bogali, where they're setting up warehouses and setting up a pipeline which can actually distribute food on a consistent basis for the next 6 months, because it's going to be needed. They are buying part of that locally. They've already sourced 20,000 metric tons of rice locally. They may need to import some as well to make sure they don't distort local markets. But that can be done. There is at the moment, or at least there was a potential problem of funding. At the moment, the WFP programme is only one-third funded for the next 6 months. So they need some more resources from the international donor community to make sure that they can keep that supply going for the next 6 months. They're not the only people who are doing it. There are other NGOs involved in that as well. But they can do it probably, they have the most experience and they can do it in the most systematic and large-scale way. But that is one of the big concerns, yes.
Thank you. We're going to move back to the question that was asked before we began. Do you want to just repeat the
Suu Kyi and whether Avaaz, this nonprofit organization, is effective in giving aid to monks who then can get it to the people on the ground?
I really can't answer your question on Aung San Suu Kyi. I mean, I'm sure she's been thinking and saying a lot about it, but if she has, it's not been able to get out to the outside world, so I simply don't know what she's been saying, I'm afraid, unfortunately. I can't comment on Avaaz in particular, but I think the NGOs, as always, have been playing an absolutely key role, both the international NGOs but also local NGOs, and particularly the Myanmar Red Cross, in getting aid through local channels to local people, to the monasteries. I mean, a tremendous amount of mobilization of private individuals and private companies playing really an extremely helpful role in all sorts of ways. I mean, there have been these concerns. I think one of the ladies mentioned, the audience mentioned it, while the military blocking this. I mean, they've obviously had difficulties in not wanting people to be seen to be dependent on charity, which is a rather unfortunate way of looking at it in present circumstances, I think. But people have been getting that aid through, and the NGOs have been affected, and they're certainly worth supporting in present circumstances, as always.
Thank you. I'm going to turn just quickly to a question that came in by email from Dennis Braun, the founder of Blueprint Asia. If the USA does not, this is the question, if the USA does not have a contingency plan to invade Burma, what are two Navy hospital and supply ships doing off the coast? Waiting for a disaster to happen? Could you please comment? Henrietta, are you still with us and able to respond to Mr. Braun's question?
Yes, I am. Thank you. U.S. military works with us in many of these relief efforts. When the Cyclone Cedar hit in Bangladesh, the most important asset that we had by our side as a humanitarian agency was the United States military. And what they bring are ships from the Navy and from the Marines that have lots of carrying capacity. So they can carry helicopters, they carry water boats, these flat-bottomed river boats, they carry large bladders that can be dropped into a small village that has no access to land, and tablets for water purification can be put into the bladders so that the people have access to clean water. So it's their capacity to help us as another agency that works with us in humanitarian ways that's most important.
Very much. I'm going to turn back to the audience here. First, there's a lady at that table, and then we'll come to the gentleman here.
Hi, my name is Sarah Dobsavaj. I work for WaterAid. I'm curious to and surprised to hear that there haven't or there don't seem to be kind of an epidemic of cholera and more waterborne diseases in a disaster of this magnitude. And I'm wondering, aside from water treatment, maybe this is for the person in the field, what efforts are being made on the sanitation front? Because clean water alone wouldn't be enough to address this issue.
Could you hear that question on the ground? From the field, could you hear that?
Can you repeat your question?
Sure. The thrust of the question was, in terms of a grateful surprise that there has been no epidemic outbreak of waterborne disease such as cholera, typhoid, or E. coli, and besides water distribution of clean water. How is the sanitation effort proceeding in terms of dealing with both the aftermath of enormous number of dead bodies as well as waste management?
We provide a chlorine tablet and water guard liquid to all our the villagers there to purify the water. But as far as now, no epidemic is happening there. But this is some sporadic outbreak, like some scattered cases of the gastroenteritis. And even in Rangoon, some people start suffering from the viral hepatitis. So apart from the waterborne disease, there are some scabies or skin infections. And most of the people are suffering from the post-traumatic stress disorder. And to regarding the water sanitation, people are now getting their drain water for the drinking purposes. And for the environmental sanitation, and no relief teams or no international organizations doing on this work. So I saw some many creeks are blocked with debris and some still with the animal carcasses, so that will be the posing some potential dangers for the waterborne disease in the future.
Thank you. That speaks to the critical importance of this issue, which we're all acutely aware of. Thank you. Yes, Jamie.
Thank you. I just have a very short question for Ambassador Menon. And that is, do you believe that the level and quality of response and international cooperation by the Burmese government is what would be expected of a member of ASEAN?
Yes, for the quality by the international organizations is the expected level of the government.
Excuse me, sir, on the ground. We're going to let you take a break for a second, and we're going to let Ambassador Menon respond to that. And if you'd like to follow on, of course, we're delighted to hear your follow-on comments. So we'll turn to Ambassador Menon first. Thank you.
We would have expected a much better response from the government of Myanmar to the crisis caused by Cyclone Nargis. I mean, that was a hope and the expectation. But I think given the mindset of the Myanmar leaders and the way they view the world, I think it took them a while, I think, to become comfortable with receiving aid from the outside world. But I think that's where the ASEAN role came in, very important. I think ASEAN interposed itself between Myanmar and the international community at a time when Myanmar was not prepared to accept international aid or was basically not showing the willingness to accept the large amounts of international aid that was being made available to Myanmar. And I think the ASEAN foreign ministers meeting in this sense played a critical role in convincing Myanmar that ASEAN will come in and help you to disabuse, I mean, to basically downplay your concerns about the international community coming in for all kinds of bad reasons. So I think it worked. I think we would have expected a much better response, but we didn't get it. I think we're working on it. The point now is no longer to look back, but to look forward. I think we made some progress. Let's build on it, and let's hope that Myanmar, I think, will be more responsive as the days go by.
And, but right now, is it at a level of what would be expected of an ASEAN member?
I think it has improved. It has improved. I mean, there is no such thing as a level for an ASEAN member. There isn't a quantifiable figure that you associate with one particular ASEAN member and the kind of response you'd expect from, let's say, Malaysia, Singapore, or Thailand. But the point is, in the case of Myanmar, there has been an improvement from where they started to where it is today. And I think that's what we're looking at. I think there's no comparison with the rest of ASEAN. Myanmar is, in a way, quite unique in itself.
Yes. Going to the next question.
Good morning. I'm Ivana Milovanovic. I'm with the WHO World Health Organization, so maybe I can offer some comments. First, I would like to thank our panelists because they gave an excellent and comprehensive overview of the situation and the things that we should focus on. Just to give one illustration, WHO is leading the health cluster, which gathers more than 40 partners, international organizations, INGOs, International Red Cross. So all these people have been deployed from the beginning, from the outset of the crisis, working to prevent outbreaks. For the moment, we are happy to report that there is no outbreak water or vector-borne disease. There are sporadic cases, but not outbreak of malaria, cholera. We have put in place a surveillance system, which is very comprehensive, so we are taking serious any report. But what I would really like to draw your attention to is that we are approaching rainy season, and with more than 50% of health system and health facilities completely devastated, we are really facing the possibility of great problem. So Health Cluster has defined the joint plan of action for the next 6 months period, and we are very grateful to all donors for helping us to put this in place. Once again, thank you to all the panelists. I just wanted to offer our comments as well. We are happy to work with you, and we will continue doing that. Thank you very much.
Thank you for those comments. Vishaka?
I'm very aware that we've kept the political and the humanitarian issues separate, but I wonder from the UN perspective whether there is a discussion now on the long-term implications on sanctions, non-sanctions, engagement, non-engagement, given what's going on and given the requirement for the next 6 months to a year that's going to need a lot more involvement. And I'd like to ask both of our colleagues from the UN to see whether there's any discussion on the sanction side of things going forward. Ambassador Menon first, possibly.
Thank you. I think the focus in the last 1 month in the UN has really been on the humanitarian situation in Myanmar. There have been attempts by some, I think, to make it to politicize, I think, the humanitarian response, the humanitarian aid that is going to Myanmar. But I think the general view, at least amongst most members of the Security Council and even in the UN in general, is that we should focus on getting aid to the people of Myanmar as quickly as possible and to deal with the political aspects much later when things are a bit more normal. But that does not mean, as John said in his opening remarks, that the political situation is completely out of the way and we're going to forget it. It's going to fall off the radar screen. No, of course not. It will remain there. And I think Ibrahim Gambari and the UN will have a role to play at the right time in trying to find a solution to the problems in Myanmar. But right now, I think the discussion hasn't been on the politics, but has been more on the humanitarian aspects. There hasn't been any discussion on sanctions as such. I mean, the point about R2P has been raised by some countries, but other than that, I think the word sanctions has not really cropped up. I mean, to impose sanctions at this time, I think it's the worst thing you can do to the people of Myanmar. And for that matter, sanctions, I believe, are not going to work, okay? Because the back door and the side doors are all open. And unless the whole international community is prepared to impose sanctions on Myanmar, I think it is not going to work. They will have room for dealing with other countries in that part of the world, India, China, and elsewhere. So I think sanctions will not work.
Singapore.
A lot of countries, including the Total having operations in Myanmar. So what do you say about that?
I mean, I think I agree, obviously, with Vanu. I mean, sanctions are a question for the Security Council to discuss, so it's not something the Secretariat gets particularly engaged in. But I think, as I was trying to suggest, obviously the politics will come back. The democratisation issues and the human rights issues are very much there. The Secretary General was very much aware of it. I think he came back feeling encouraged that we should go on pushing ahead with engagement with the authorities to see where we can get with that, following his own discussions with Tan Shui. And hopefully Ibrahim Gambari will be able to go back relatively soon, I don't know exactly when, and hopefully make more progress than he has perhaps in his in the last mission. So that policy is very much alive and will be pushed forward with all vigour as the immediate humanitarian crisis diminishes. We hope.
Thank you. I think we have time for two more questions. I see two hands. We'll go first to this gentleman and then the lady at the table there. Yes.
Thank you. Sean Turnell from Burma Economic Watch. This is a question mostly for Sir John Holmes. At present, Burma is currently accruing about $100 to $150 million a month from its sales of gas from the from the fields that the gas is ultimately sold to Thailand. I'm just wondering, given that and given the funding shortages for the World Food Programme and so on, if you could articulate the principles behind the international fundraising efforts, given that the Burmese government itself seems to be in possession of substantial resources.
Well, it's a good question. Clearly, the Myanmar government themselves are contributing a lot to the relief effort. They have given figures, I haven't got them in my head. I mean, I think it was 70 billion Myanmar chats, which is around $70 million, I think something like that was the last figure I heard while I was there. And I think they were talking about spending something like $5 million a day themselves on the relief effort. I can't verify those figures, I'm simply passing them on. But in all circumstances like this, we believe that the international community can supplement and support whatever the national government is doing. And, you know, we give a lot of international assistance, even to countries which are relatively wealthy. If you look at the humanitarian effort in Darfur, which is 95% funded by the international community, even though the Sudanese government has very, very large income from oil now, we are raising money internationally on the humanitarian side for Iraq. Iraq is sitting on vast numbers of billions of dollars from its oil revenue as well. Now, why do we do that? I mean, there's a good question, a philosophical question, which I won't go into, but it's partly because there is a feeling that if we don't do that or supplement those efforts, it won't happen, and therefore we feel a sort of moral, ethical imperative to supplement these efforts. And also we can contribute something which is not just money, which is a systematic approach to the humanitarian relief effort, making sure that all the main areas are covered by the international organisations, whether they be UN agencies or international NGOs, to make sure that the food's covered, the water's covered, the sanitation is covered in a systematic way, which a national government perhaps won't always do. So that's one of the reasons why we go in for these appeals, even where national resources, in theory, could cover it.
Our last question.
Thank you. I'm Shamla Kandaya from Security Council Report. And my question is sort of an ASEAN question. Given the way the UN and ASEAN has worked on this relief operation, do you feel that there's a way, given the way the Myanmar government feels about the Security Council and its weariness as far as the council is concerned, in which ASEAN could play a role in this area in sort of getting them to open up and the idea of some of the things that Gambari has been doing? Are there sort of ways in which ASEAN could sort of work more closely or in a more direct way to do that? I mean, in the past, ASEAN has tried to work with Myanmar. It hasn't always been successful. But I'm wondering whether in partnering with the UN, there might be a new format that could be used.
I think, Shamla, that was a very good question. I mean, as you said yourself, I think we tried in the past to get involved in trying to find a political solution to the problems of Myanmar. And Myanmar has basically rebuffed ASEAN and made it quite clear. In fact, at the last meeting of the ASEAN leaders in Singapore in December, Myanmar made it quite clear they would rather deal with the international community by itself rather than through ASEAN. You know, and that was the message we got from Myanmar in Singapore when they met, the leaders met in December. So since then, ASEAN is basically saying, look, we'll step aside for the time being. We're ready to help you as and when you want our help. And I think this is one instance where we offered our help and it was taken up. So I think after this, let's see, I mean, if the Myanmars feel extremely comfortable with ASEAN and feel that, look, there's something that ASEAN can do to help them in the political process, I'm sure ASEAN is ready to come in and get involved. We're not saying hands off, you know, completely. We're going to get involved if they want our help. But their request must come from them. If they want our help, I think ASEAN is ready to help. And hopefully the lesson from Cyclone Nargis and the handling of Cyclone Nargis and the involvement of ASEAN is that Myanmar will come back and ask us to help them in some way to find a solution. But let's see. Thank you.
I want to thank our panelists. I especially want to thank the gentlemen in the field for taking the time to be able to join us today and for your very clear comments. Again, we wish you all the best with your critical efforts. Also, I'd like to thank Henrietta for joining us for such an extended period from Macedonia. Thank you. And, of course, to Sir John and Ambassador Menon here and to the Asia Society and the Open Society Institute. Thank you all.